It gives me great pleasure to introduce Professor Carrie Nankivell. She has been a professor here at DKI APCSS since 2008. She's a maritime security specialist with broad expertise in the Asian littoral. She's published on maritime issues, including the South China Sea disputes, naval modernization, piracy, and other non-traditional challenges. Without any further ado, Professor Nankivell.
Thanks, Mike. Aloha, everybody. Good morning. How are we on this Thursday in APOC? Wow, this week is going by fast. making you feel worse. My name is Carrie Lynn Nankivell, and it's my pleasure to have a little bit over the next hour with you to discuss this really important topic. As Mike mentioned, I've been a faculty member at APCSS for 10 years, and it's been amazing to me how much this topic has grown in strategic prominence in that decade. It may surprise you to hear, it certainly surprised me, that when I got here in 2008, some people weren't sure what maritime security was and why it was important. Flash forward to 2018, and I don't get that question as often as I used to. Maritime issues have been much in the news, particularly related to your line of work. How many people here work in a maritime service? Either the Navy, the Coast Guard, or the Marines? Okay, so about balanced. So you obviously understand the relevance of the maritime space for strategic Indo-Pacific. But increasingly, people who work in non-maritime services and agencies are also very interested in events at sea. And so what I'm going to try to do in the next hour is not overview everything that's going on in the sea space, because that would not be possible in the time we have, but to kind of paint a portrait for you of maritime Indo-Pacific and its underlying sort of foundational drivers. We'll touch on a few issues that you can deal with in seminar in much greater detail, and my slides will be available to you in there as well if you want to go over some of the data that I'll provide. But I hope we will have about 30 minutes for a detailed Q&A where you can ask very specific questions. But this opening is really going to be more of a portrait to try to help us unpack the nature of Indo-Pacific sea power and how it has defined and continues to define the strategic space. All right, so we all read a lot about the Indo-Pacific century these days, and a lot can be said and has been said on this topic. What I want to focus on this morning are two fundamental observations that I hope you'll carry with you that certainly frame my understanding of the contemporary region. The first fundamental observation that is very important is that while Asia's maritime rise is most visible in China in the post-Mao era, it's actually a broad-based and sustained trend. The first movers in this trend were not in China, but were actually on its periphery, in Japan, in Singapore, Hong Kong, Taiwan. And in a lot of ways, when Deng Xiaoping opened up China in the early 1980s, he was guided by those models which advocated for a turn to the sea. So while we might talk about China as the most improved player in the Asia-Pacific region in recent decades, it is certainly not the only important one, and it was not the leader of this regional change. The second observation, which gives rise to the first, is that the headline story of the maritime Indo-Pacific is not a military one. It's a commercial one. The leading edge of Asia's dramatic change that we all read so much about has been driven by a revolution in commercial sea power and not by naval ambitions. Shanghai, which is pictured behind me, and the other Asian megacities that drive Asia forward are profoundly connected to the sea. China's embrace of the blue economy is unprecedented in scale, but it is not alone. Deng Xiaoping, as I mentioned, borrowed liberally from an export-driven model that not only proved but demonstrated the overwhelming appeal of an economy that was enmeshed in globalized integrated supply chains. This export-led model meant that cheap labor, which is available in pretty large supply around the world, could be profitably connected to wealthy consumers far away. This was enabled by massive state-led investments in maritime infrastructure and complementary maritime industries like commercial shipbuilding. A study completed in late 2016 in China found a near-perfect correlation between the growth in China's so-called blue economy, like port services, shipbuilding, insurance, the wider sort of maritime logistics services that naturally are required to function in to make a maritime economy function, found a near-perfect correlation between the growth in that sector of the economy and Chinese growth overall. This regression analysis only confirms what many maritime specialists have always suspected, which is that modern China has very salty foundations. Okay? And that's true not just of China, but of the economies on which China's export-led development was modeled. What Asia has accomplished thus far is staggering, and it's largely been enabled by the technology you see behind me. For specialists, containerization is seen as the third transportation revolution, which has defined our modern standard of living, particularly in the United States and in other Western developed economies. Its effect on our way of life and the way we do business with one another has only been matched by innovations like steam and rail. And it was not even an invention, it was an innovation, driven by the simple observation that if we put everything in like-sized boxes, rather than load and unload long-distance cargo by hand, that we can drive transportation costs so low that they're no longer a cost factor in our commercial and investment decisions. Okay, this innovation was developed in the United States, not by anybody related to the maritime industry, but by a trucking magnate who, frustrated with dockside labor, understood that if he could just drive his trucks onto a flat-topped ship, that he could save himself a lot of headache and a lot of money. Okay, so that was the beginning. And what it's translated into is what you see behind me. Now, this ship is the Maersk Triple E. Not long ago, it was one of the world's largest container ships. It can carry 18,000 boxes. It's about 400 meters long. For those of you who aren't Canadian like me, that's about 1,200 feet. That makes them 17% larger than a Nimitz-class carrier, although, of course, they have less firepower. And despite this size, it can transit from Spain to Singapore in 20 days. This ship gains economies not just of scale, but also of fuel costs. The sea is simply more permissive as a domain for transit than any other domain, including air. It offers a 99.5% emissions reduction from air freight and an 18% lower fuel cost from rail, making it not just more profitable, but also more sustainable. To take all of the Triple E's boxes from one place to another would require 110 kilometers of rail line. And thus far, the laws of physics, as we understand them, don't allow the profitable transit of a train 110 kilometers long. By air, it would require 800 cargo transits to transport this much stuff from, say, Shenzhen to California. For most of human history, if something came from really far away, it was very expensive. And people thought really carefully about what was worth transiting from one side of our planet to the other. Anybody who goes to Walmart as much as I do, or my kids do, knows that this is no longer true. Stuff from very far away is often cheaper than things that are made in our own backyard. This is a profound historical curiosity. It has changed the nature of our lives, not just the nature of our economies. And certainly, it has changed the way we think about sea power and the security environment. Okay, so what does this mean, getting back to sea power and maritime strategy? Well, let's start with this commercial driving force. There are two possible stories. And these stories are linked to stories we tell ourselves about the economy, which I know you talked about a couple of days ago with Dr. Foreman. And we can certainly discuss that a little more in Q&A if you'd like. But I want to think about how those stories translate into guiding points for maritime strategy. Okay, there are two possible stories about global merchandise trade. The first is that the global economy in the last 15, say 18 years, has grown so large, an overall increase in 312% in terms of the value of what we send from one side of the ocean to the other, that we are all integrated with one another. We are more deeply interconnected economically than we've ever been. And it's by virtue of our shared dependence on an ungoverned and ungovernable domain. Right? The ocean is wide. It is deep. It is owned by no one. We're all in it together. Right? That story sort of lends itself to Jeff Till, who's a prominent navalist based out of London in the UK, has called postmodern naval strategy, which is intensely cooperative. Right? We have a shared dependence. War is irrational. There are non-traditional threats inherent to the domain that present challenges to us all. And we naturally will band together to grapple with that vulnerability. Okay, so think about anti-piracy coalitions or counter-terrorist coalitions, that kind of thing. Okay. The second story that we could tell about maritime strategy in this salty economy is premised on a focus on relative gains. Relative gains. So yes, we have a shared interdependence, but we also have intensified vulnerabilities vis-a-vis one another, which has led to mutual suspicion and intensified strategic competition. As individual nations, we are much more dependent on the viability of sometimes narrow sea lanes, which lie in very uncomfortably close proximity to other nations whom we may not trust. Okay? Paul, can you go back to slide number 6 and just go through that animation again? Paul? Let's see if we can do it. Let's see, otherwise I have to go back. I'll exercise my thumbs this morning. Okay, so if you look at this graph, the orange slice of the pie is the United States' share of global merchandise trade, and the dark blue is China's. Since 2006, the United States' share of the growing pie has been reduced from 12% to 6%. In that same period of time, the Chinese share of a growing pie, everybody's getting wealthier, the Chinese share of the growing pie has gone from 18 to 31. Okay? Overall, Asia as a trading economy has gone from about 50% to 60, and all the indicators are moving towards further growth. In fact, the most profitable sea lanes in the world are predicted to be, in the next 15 years, almost entirely intra-Asian. That is, those sea lanes that connect developed Asia with developing Asia, not sea lanes that connect the United States to Asia across the Pacific. and certainly not that once very important, but less important these days, sea lane across the Atlantic, connecting Europe with the United States. So what does that mean for maritime strategy? What does that mean for the incentive to invest in and think hard about naval modernization, global presence, broad-based whole of government or whole of society maritime purpose? All of those things are shifting. And there's a natural discomfort with that that I think we see in lots of places. The United States has been the acknowledged and undeniable maritime hegemon in the Indo-Pacific since the end of the war in 1945. And I know most American audiences are not comfortable with the word hegemon. Can insert some other word there. But the United States has had an intense interest in and success in the maritime domain, has operated in a largely permissive environment right up to the littorals for a very long time. Driven by commercial change in Asia, even if we don't know anything about the character of the governments or the populations that they represent, that is likely to change, just looking at the data. Other countries can, will, and do have an increasing interest in the sea and can be expected to play a larger role in defining its outcomes vis-a-vis the United States, right? So there are profound shifts. Okay, so the profit potential of containerized trade continues to explode. We're figuring out how to containerize more and more different kinds of things. The only hint that there may be some change to this trend has come from a few people who write about the potential of 3D printing, or additive manufacturing, it's now called, although there are many doubts that that will be able to replace the profit gains that we know already exist by virtue of our ability to move more stuff more quickly at less cost at longer distance than ever before. Asia's ports are integral nodes in the global logistics chain, and it's important when you're thinking about strategy to bear that in mind, that aggregate trade data, aggregate export volumes only tell a big picture of the story. Underneath that, there's a structural reality that is very different from bilateral trading relationships in the past. And that's that containerization is a large carpooling system where megaports are connected by motherships who feed smaller lines going out to smaller destinations. That's why it's cost advantageous. Those megaports are not just vehicles for national economies, they're also major transshipment hubs that facilitate the cheap movement of goods all around the world. In Asia, these nodes, these transshipment hubs, change over time, but in the last 20 to 25 years, they've been the ones that you see on the slide. So the port of Shanghai, the port of Singapore, the port of Busan in South Korea, and the port of Hong Kong are important national assets. They're also important regional assets from a commercial logistics standpoint. They're unique sites of sea power. They have incredible logistical leverage. They're also vulnerable to state and non-state actors seeking to have disproportionate effects on the global economy. They punch above their weight in both maritime circles, but in broader geopolitical circles as well. And they're important to bear in mind as perhaps first among equals, at least in the maritime seascape as it is shaped today. All right, so I mentioned that the headline story of sea power in Asia is a commercial one, but of course it gives rise to a second act, which is more familiar to this audience probably, which is the military one. It makes sense that with growing stakes in sea lanes and growing budgets thanks to GDP growth, we're seeing governments investing in defense capabilities at higher absolute amounts and in some cases even higher rates than we have in past. So we'd expect to see kind of a line of best fit that shows GDP growth matched with growth in defense budgets. That's what sort of a scientific eye would expect to see, and that is largely what we see. Okay, now there are a few outliers. There are some economies that are spending more in defense growth than their economies would suggest is wise, and vice versa. But largely, increasing capability in the Asia-Pacific is in line with what we might expect if we assume that the economy is underpinned by maritime connectivity that is vulnerable to disruption. Okay, so you can put, therefore, the major economies, the important players in, or some of the important players in the Asia-Pacific in a couple of boxes. We have some high-growth spenders, economies that are growing fast, where defense capabilities are changing quickly. Some of them are the ones you would expect, like China, obviously we read a lot. Vietnam, also in this category. Indonesia, also in this category. You see some balancers. Balancers whose economies are doing very well, balancers whose economies are kind of increasing at a more moderate rate. And we also see some economizers. Now, Japan obviously falls in this category. Japan is very unique for lots of reasons. First of all, that they already have a large and established high-end economy, which can be expected to post lower rates of growth than an economy that's starting from a lower base. And they also have self-imposed restraints on how much they'll spend on defense. Historically, they've capped their defense spending at about 1%. This is not a constitutional requirement. It's just a customary habit of Japanese governments, which means it can change over time. But even underneath that economizing posture, Japan is making some very important and strategically significant soft tissue changes to the way it uses its military capability, which is already quite considerable, particularly in the maritime domain. They're investing a lot in ASW, for example, in advanced positioning in the southwestern part of Japan, which is most vulnerable to competing Chinese sovereignty claims and to Chinese incursions in what they see as their domestic space. So the budget numbers don't tell the whole story, is all I'm saying. But the regional trend, broadly speaking, follows the argument that I'm making, which is that it's a commercial maritime-based revolution that is changing Asian seascapes, and this necessarily is followed by a military change just as dramatic. So getting outside of kind of the hard data, what do we observe about strategic evolution of the major players? In China, we can see a clear and undeniable assertive approach to China's near seas. The government in Beijing has brought a maritime strategy to its near approaches on steroids. It's, of course, underpinned by really impressive naval modernization, which some of you may be very familiar with already. But it also brings a whole of society focus, which is very unusual and new, especially to US audiences. China is known to be and documented to have mobilized not just the commercial shipbuilding sector, but also fishermen to pursue the interests of the state in this contested space. They have sent out a fleet of diplomats, some pretending to be lawyers, to influence the way that other nations understand and support or don't support different instruments of international law, both written and customary. They have embarked on a large campaign to raise the maritime consciousness of the Chinese people through dedicated messaging to its own national public. As a result of this whole of society approach, China brings to the domain a very enviable high-low mix. They have increasingly sophisticated high-end capabilities, particularly in supporting domains like space and cyber, but also with respect to their missile capabilities ashore and at sea. But they also have a large amount of low-end assets, including in the paramilitary and semi-civilian realm, which present really challenging seascapes to more traditional players like the United States. Farther afield, it's more difficult to ascertain China's strategic vector. The Indian Ocean, in particular, is much written about and debated about, and maybe there are some who want to discuss it in seminar or in Q&A. It is much, much harder to pinpoint China's coherent, articulated strategy in that space. China's current five-year plan talks about maritime strategy primarily in economic terms, including with reference to China's maritime rights, as Beijing understands them, and interests, which don't always lie close to China itself. Right? China's new military facility in Djibouti, as well as its aggressive and non-commercially substantiated investments under One Belt, One Road in key port facilities around the Indian Ocean, for example, or beyond, can be understood in one of two ways. Either an aggressive push to bring the global economy and its political culture under the Chinese sort of vision, or a growing integration of China with the rest of the world, where they can exploit their comparative advantage in maritime industries for the domestic benefit of their economy, and participate in some of those postmodern coalition operations, which I already talked about, like anti-piracy. Now we can, and I'm sure many people do a detailed analysis of the capabilities at the Chinese facility in Djibouti, for example, to try to ascertain which story is the more compelling one about Chinese activities in the Indian Ocean. But without actual confrontation or challenge, it's very hard to let the hardware speak for itself or the investment speak for itself. Discerning intent is clearly an art and not a science. And so a lot of your interpretation of Chinese ambitions in the Indian Ocean will depend on some of your assumptions or gut instincts about China itself that you bring to the exercise, right? The data doesn't clearly speak for itself. We see a lot of activity. There's no officially articulated goals. And again, there's more than one story we can tell about it, but clearly this is a space worth watching and discussing for many years to come. What about the United States? Well, the United States has recently developed a US Indo-Pacific strategy, whose headline is A Free and Open Indo-Pacific. APCSS had the privilege of conducting a regional workshop that contributed to the development of this strategy, soliciting some feedback from around the region. And it was previewed, in the words of the Secretary of Defense, at the recent Shangri-La Defense Ministers meeting in Singapore. So what are its pillars? Well, the first is expanding attention to the maritime space. So in an overall regional security strategy, an explicit recognition that the maritime space is a key driver of any outcome in this region. Second, a focus on interoperability, which is partly a focus on allies and partners, following the principle that the president laid out in the national security strategy that the US should focus on partners that are strong and not partners that are weak, right? So maybe less of a focus on building capacity of partners that might pay dividends in the future, an increasing focus on those partners with which we already have established relationships to intensify and deepen our ability to work with them on short notice if and as required. The third pillar was strengthening the rule of law, civil society, and transparent governance. And the fourth, closely related, was private sector-led economic development, including through development finance for critical infrastructure. Both of those two pillars stand in clear contrast with China's One Belt, One Road approach, which, while welcomed by most developing states in the region, is constantly and rightly, I think, critiqued for being too opaque, too arbitrary, and tied up with a lot of political strings. The president, during his campaign and close after his election, reiterated his support for a larger US Navy. That has not been discussed in as much detail this year as it was last year, so we can interpret that as we may. But the question remains, if this is the US strategy, what resources and what activities will the United States take under these pillars to deliver strategic effect? So if in China we see a lack of articulated strategic goals and a lot of activity, some might critique the United States' strategy for the opposite, that we see a very clearly articulated strategy that rests on long-standing bipartisan US principles for security in our region, but we're yet to see major changes in the underlying activities. Again, for the observer like me, it means watch this space. Okay? But I started off saying that this wasn't all about China. I know it kind of sounds like it is, given what I've said so far. So what about the rest? Well, again, it's very, very important to remain aware that China and the United States are not the only important or formidable players in this space, either in military or commercial terms. Japan and India continue to be very important players to take account of, and both countries, under their current leadership, but arguably even before, have adopted a more maritime-oriented posture during their term in office. Whether it's Prime Minister Modi's Act East policy, which has brought India to have critical infrastructure discussions, for example, with a wider range of partners in ASEAN and even as far east as Fiji, or Prime Minister Abe's more focused approach on reorganizing and recommitting to not just the Navy or the Maritime Self-Defense Force, but also the Coast Guard, and widening the scope for both agencies to operate themselves farther and farther abroad, and even to exercise and assist a greater range of maritime partners. In 2015, Prime Minister Abe made amendments to Japan's Overseas Development Assistance Charter, which allowed Japan to provide military and paramilitary assistance to other states for the first time since the end of World War II. A lot of that ODA funding gets, at least with respect to maritime development, gets funded through the Coast Guard, who continues to provide aid to Southeast Asian states in particular in support of the freedom of navigation, commercial navigation, so Coast Guard type assistance. But increasingly, it also includes sort of higher-end capability assistance and even the transfer of major hardware platforms. Indonesia has similarly a leadership right now that is very focused on Indonesia's role in the Indo-Pacific as a maritime leader. President Jokowi was elected under a banner of Indonesian rejuvenation and reestablishment of Indonesia as the maritime fulcrum of the Indo-Pacific, thanks to its strategic location at the crossroads of two oceans. It's taken some contemporary policy and hardware forms, like the president and his fisheries minister's robust approach to illegal, unregulated, and unreported fishing in Indonesian waters. And it's also taken sort of a softer side in terms of diplomacy and cultural renewal. His government has embarked on a campaign to reawaken Indonesians' awareness of their own maritime heritage. Okay, so kind of a similar whole of society ambition as China, although the execution has been a little less robust. ASEAN, Taiwan, also very important players, especially on the littorals of the South China Sea, a body of water of a lot of interest to the United States, have also increasingly talked in maritime terms, engaged in sea-based activities, exercises, diplomacy, declarations, and in Taiwan's case, the start of an indigenous submarine construction program, something that has been long on their to-do list, seemed impossible for more than a decade, and is now a reality on that island. Okay, so again, the point is that Asia's maritime rise is about more than one player or two players. And the big so what of that is that the space is much, much more complicated than it used to be. It certainly is more complicated than the Cold War context was, where you had one player jostling with another. Now you have many important, wealthy, capable players pursuing their own ambitions in the same space. Here's just one portrait of that with respect to naval acquisitions, recent and planned. These aren't final fleets. These are assets that have either been recently acquired or, again, have been announced or in the process of construction. And I focus on subsurface assets and because submarines are largely seen as a proxy variable for increasing uncertainty and mutual suspicion between neighbors. Unlike even large deck acquisitions like Australia's new amphibious large vessels or the helicopter carrier in Japan, submarines have no known utility in humanitarian assistance and disaster response missions. Right? So if you're looking for one quick data snapshot that provides evidence of suspicion, arms racing, or potential strategic conflict, submarines are usually used as one. Do not overlook that there has also been a paramilitary complement to this broad naval modernization. Coast guards around the Indo-Pacific are increasing in number and in strength and mandate, and therefore in significance. Each Coast Guard star on the map is a location where there has been a major strategic reorganization or even standing up and major recapitalization of a national Coast Guard. The littorals of Asia are hardening. National jurisdictions are beginning to be enforced in ways that they were never able to be enforced before. And not every nation, including some of the United States' partners in the region, have the same understanding of internationally allowable jurisdictions in their exclusive economic zone. Right? In the United States and around the world, the mainstream view is that the exclusive economic zone is legally entitled to exactly that: exclusive exploitation and management of any resource with economic value. Beyond that, any activities, including navigation, freedom to exercise, and even the freedom to collect intelligence, remains as it has been for centuries, which is that all navigating states can engage in those activities so long as they are for a peaceful purpose outside of 12 nautical miles. Okay, that's the mainstream view. It was subject of a lot of discussion during the negotiation of the UN Law of the Sea, and that was the view that prevailed, which is why the United States signed the document, although it did not ratify. We're still waiting. But that is not the mainstream view in large parts of Asia. It's not the Chinese view, of course. You probably know that already. They object to any military navigation inside their economic zone and even farther inside their nine-dash line. But that view is shared by U.S. allies like Thailand, by U.S. partners like Malaysia. Okay, so the debate is pretty much closed around the world, but in Asia, particularly in Southeast Asia, it is alive and well. Okay, so the hardening of the littoral, again, has both a good and a bad news story associated with it. On the one hand, the sea space is becoming better governed. Transnational threats might be able to be dealt with. We have more capable partners. The U.S. Coast Guard has a counterpart with which it can exercise and operate in a variety of contingencies. On the other hand, countries that are seeking to expand their territorial jurisdictions out to 200 nautical miles, and when I say territorial, I mean full enforcement of all domestic laws, including restrictions on the movement and activities of foreign militaries, they now have more capability to do that than ever before, which of course presents a challenge not just to the United States, but to all navigating nations, particularly where the geography gets tight and close in. Right? Okay. But so what? Right? Okay, so this will be our big picture. Takeaways, which I think reflects my own professional assessment that in the seascape of the Indo-Pacific, we're dealing with a situation in which the glass is both half empty and half full. If you count yourself, as I do, as a person who believes that navies and coast guards are the good guys in regional security, there clearly are some things that are easier to do today in the Indo-Pacific than ever before. Regional states are better able to police their patch of ocean. New players can make meaningful contributions, not just symbolic contributions, but meaningful contributions to our shared security. The picture in this slide is from an ASEAN Defense Ministers Meeting Plus, or ADMM Plus, maritime security exercise, which was held in 2013, in which ASEAN and their eight dialogue partners contributed hardware assets to a scenario-based exercise at sea. 20 years ago, this was not possible or even necessarily politically desirable by people in the region. So, for example, our ability to respond together to humanitarian crises, perhaps driven by natural weather events, is greater today than it's ever been before, thanks to a broad-based Asian maritime rise. Even on the pointier end, we're seeing incredible advances, innovations in coalition opportunities to counter transnational threats that involve violence. And that includes piracy, of course, also includes the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction or trafficking at sea. This photo is a photo not just of a coalition, but a coalition of coalitions operating in the Gulf of Aden to counter the explosive threat of piracy that was presented in those waters between about 2007 and 2011. So understanding that each of the states with stakes in the outcome of that waterway didn't necessarily have operational comfort with one another or even strategic trust. The Gulf of Aden coalition of coalitions structure provides proof that we can cooperate against our narrow shared interests if the structure is right. So in that instance, the European Union, a US-led combined task force, and a variety of standalone partners, all coordinated in a fairly confined geography to accomplish a single shared goal. Navies like India's and Pakistan's, like Japan and China's, like Russia and the United States, could all coordinate with one another, even in some cases communicate from platform to platform, to provide a unified front against some pretty impressive non-state actors. This took a lot of intricate diplomacy and planning, processes that you may be asked to undertake from your chairs, depending on what career field you're in. It was not easy to accomplish. They made it look easy, and it seems like a no-brainer now, but it was an incredible amount of hard work, leaps of faith, and innovations in cooperative structures that was made possible by rising capabilities, by increasing awareness of our shared dependence, and by a willingness to try something new. Okay? On the other hand, we'd be remiss to be too Pollyanna-ish about what increasing capabilities or the consequences of modernization in the Indo-Pacific might be. China's developments in the South China Sea, its militarization of the entire space from the Paracel Islands to the Spratlys farther to the southeast, remind us that naval, as well as Coast Guard and civilian activities, not to mention attendant Air Force and missile capabilities, can and often do unsettle regional relationships in perhaps an irreversible way. Capability is generally a good thing, but when it's conducted in contested zones or on disputed territories, and where it threatens long-established customs and treaty law at sea, there is a lot of cause for concern along multiple axes. This is particularly true when there is no transparent or obvious peaceful purpose for any of these activities. I know there's an elective on some of these developments, which I would encourage you to attend if you're interested in a more detailed look, and we can, of course, talk about it in Q&A. Keeping with my theme of broad-based maritime change, I do need to highlight that China is not the only actor driven by its perceived national security needs to be doing things differently in the South China Sea. So this photo shows Spratly Island, which is Vietnam occupied, which has also been the site of some reclamation and increased militarization. Now, please don't misunderstand me. Vietnam has reclaimed about 4% of the territory that China has. But it does remind us that there are many determined actors in the South China Sea. There is more than one strategic imperative at work. And cooperating in this space, making partnerships in this space, finding a win-win for everybody is increasingly difficult. So there are some things that are easier today in the maritime space than before, and there are some things that are getting much harder. There are, in fact, some things that we don't talk very often about that remain firmly in the way too hard to do box and are so hard that we almost don't even talk about them in diplomatic forums with in any meaningful way. So despite our staggering economic successes, and they have been staggering, again, we're trading and living like no humans have ever traded or lived before. But despite that staggering success, there are still significant populations of have-nots in the Asian seascape. The growth of maritime-based economies in East Asia have not translated into similar growth patterns all around the littoral in an even way. There are many maritime communities that operate as they have for centuries, like these small-scale fishermen in Chennai, India. For these men, and they're almost always men, the most tangible evidence that they have of change in the global maritime economy is increasing amounts of plastic and other garbage that fills their fishnets. And so for them, globalization really has just made their jobs a lot harder and less profitable than it was centuries ago. Obviously, there's an environmental and sustainability component to this challenge. There's also a more obvious security implication. because these maritime communities are able and can and do take to the sea to find solutions, just like the rest of us, except they take to the sea as refugees, as asylum seekers, as irregular migrants in search of work. It's becoming increasingly clear that these marginalized communities are not just humanitarian issues. They're also direct challenges to sovereignty, to security, and to stability. The sea has become an arena for their ambitions as well. And they, like the rest of us, are also armed with communications technologies, with global media, and with political influence far beyond their own borders. Their activities often include organized criminal networks that are hardened and resistant to governance, that enable human trafficking, drug trafficking, arms trafficking, large-scale IUU fishing, and environmental degradation, and even slavery at sea, which we know is an unfortunate but widespread reality. The continued dislocation of Asia's most unfortunate communities creates clear us versus them dynamics. Sometimes states organize on one side of the us against non-state actors. Other times the cleavages are more complicated. For example, in ASEAN, which has been such an important player in South China Sea negotiations and dynamics, there are two clear camps. There are some countries that have a lot of stake in the stability of commercial navigation and in global sea lanes, like Singapore or Malaysia or Indonesia or Vietnam. And they're incentivized to manage the South China Sea carefully and with a view to cooperation and stability and continued access. There are others, like Cambodia or Laos, for example, which have no stake in global sea lanes and have very little incentive to rock the boat, so to speak, with their most important economic player that clearly has hegemonic ambitions. ASEAN's major task going forward will be to reconcile these cleavages. But all to say that the division between haves and have-nots in maritime Asia will continue to present challenges that sometimes take the shape of security threats and sometimes take the shape of really formidable diplomatic obstacles. Still in the hard-to-do box. Most tricky, there are some spaces, particularly this one, in which all of these trends are seeming to converge on a single geographic space. All of the success stories and our shared interdependence, all of the challenges and the hardening of the littoral and competing maritime ambitions, and all of the transnational challenge which threaten the viability of the sea, at least as an economic and ecological resource, are all converging on one space, which explains its strategic significance and our fascination with watching it unfold. I think I'm going to end there with my portrait of the Indo-Pacific. I'm looking forward to your questions. I'm happy to discuss anything that you saw or didn't see about maritime Asia. And I'm hoping that I can send you to an interesting seminar discussion.